Reminder, if you do not want to be recorded, please say so before you speak so that we remember to pause the recording device. So let's start with the first question. It's sort of a two-part question, and it asks, what is indirectly social labor, and how is an understanding of indirectly social labor relevant to Gray's proposed monetary reform? Anyone want to take a stab at that?
Try, and then I should take my own advice. I won't speak again for a long time. But you want me to hit this one?
Sure.
Okay. This is very important. I'm not positive I have it exactly right, but I hope so. Okay, indirectly social labor is how workers relate to each other in capitalist society, where they produce for value. What Marx calls a material quality possessed by the products of labor. The relationship between the workers is mediated by money or by the products of their labor, which distort and obscure any semblance of equality in the relationships among the people who produce them. In contrast to that indirectly social labor, what Marx here in the CGP calls, quote, the cooperative society based on common ownership of the means of production, close quote, then individual labor is no longer indirect. It's a direct component part of the total labor of the society. And in the lower phase of communism, everyone's hours of labor count the same. They're not measured by exchange of products, because products aren't exchanged directly anyway. They're certainly not measured by capitalist value, which we've done away with producing for value, and we have a different basis for production. So Gray didn't mind indirectly social labor because his, quote, monetary reform, doing away with money, was going to give workers supposedly equal remuneration for their labor. The products of labor will be essentially, what I gather, are to be treated as money that the workers can put in the bank and they can draw other products out. And Marx says of Gray, by his treating commodities produced as immediately money, that he means to have the goods produced as commodities, just not exchanged as commodities. So Gray's bank is also a warehouse for the goods produced, and it parcels them out in exchange for the, quote, labor money the worker gets for his hours of labor. So, in other words, Gray's changed the name of money to labor money. Marx points out that such a bank would also be directing production. It would have to make the whole system work. And meanwhile, nothing has changed about how work is actually done. And so Marx, of course, holds that you cannot separate the mode of production from distribution. Over.
Anyone else want to speak to this question?
This is Stephanie. I will, but I'll wait till others speak because I speak a lot. Over.
Okay, why don't we do Peter? Which Peter was that?
Peter Jones.
Okay, please speak away.
Okay, thanks. Will, would you mind not recording me?
Sure, and I'm just going to preface what I say next with, in case I'm overlapping with what people have already said, I apologize, but I think I'm not. I said that in Gray's, and this is in the second part of the question, I said that in Gray's schema, goods are still produced as commodities, even though Gray was trying to do away with transforming exchange value into price, hence trying to eliminate the goods produced as commodities from being exchanged as commodities. Marx said that commodities can only be directly compared as the things that they are, like their essential nature, I guess. Not, as Gray tried to have it, as directly compared with one another as products of social labor. And that seems to be like this ongoing problem with bourgeois reforms. So it's as if Gray has to keep it disentangling his bourgeois reforms from the entanglements of capitalist production and just removing the arena of commodity exchange to that of a national bank does not eliminate the bourgeois conditions of exchange nor of production. Over.
Does anyone have an answer for Peter's question?
Brendan?
Yes, is that Andrew?
Yeah, I've never been able to locate a copy of Gray's book. But Marx clearly interprets it in the sense of the exchange of labor. In other words, that one gets a chit or whatever based on hours. Because he does refer to Gray presupposing that the labor time is immediately social labor. The point is that in the quantity of commodities, then you wouldn't have you wouldn't have the equality that he seems to be looking for, right? The way Marx puts it, this is right after he first introduces Gray. In exchange for the commodity, the producer would receive an official certificate of its value, that is, a receipt for as much labor time as his commodity contained. And this banknote of one labor week, one labor day, one labor hour, etc., would serve as an order to the bank to hand over an equivalent in other commodities. It just seems to be defeating the whole purpose or the whole conception that the product would have a value independent of the labor. The idea seems to be to equate the value to the labor. Over.
Before we move on to question two, I wonder if anyone has any other clarifying questions about the concept of indirectly social labor, just because I think it's sort of crucial for moving forward with the conversation.
Torvald?
Yes, please.
Well, the way I understand it, and I might be wrong here, so please correct me if I am, is indirectly social labor means that every individual labor is part of social labor, but not sort of this individual part is equalized to an average, or in other words, it counts as an average. And the reason why this happens is the competition between producers and consumers. So producers cannot set their prices according to the amount of individual labor they expend in their own production processes. Over.
I think that's very clear, the way you put that. Does anyone else have anything with indirectly social labor?
I'll comment this briefly, Ravi.
Yes, Ravi.
I think that the way in which Gray presents the problem of society is one in which he sees, he's almost fetishizing money and the money form itself as a source of all problems. And so he thinks by removing that, then all the difficulties of capitalism will be removed. So it's not so much that he questions the form of production or the forms of distribution that arise from that. He thinks that removing the money form and allowing commodities to change directly with each other so that every commodity becomes a money form, is going to solve the problems of society. I think that's about as far as you get from reading what Marx is saying about him. Over.
This is Stephanie. I just have a question for you, Brendan, since you're the question writer. Do you think that we've adequately talked about like what your comprehension of where you wanted us, what you wanted us to say or think and know about what is indirectly social labor versus social labor? Over.
Yeah, I think some people have said some pretty clear things. I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page, because I know the concept is a little bit tricky. I just want to make sure that we're on the same page before we move forward.
Shiny.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I don't want to sort of drag it out, but I do think the notion of value that it also buys into that whole thing about fetishism. I mean, the value appears as a thing in the product, and so because the social nature of production is recognized only in exchange, because the labor is indirectly recognized, then that's what value is. But it seems like it's a product of a quality of the product itself, when it's a product of the social arrangements around the product. So once you have direct social labor, the concept of value, or the appearance of value, will change. I think that's the double character of labor that Marx talks about.
Brendan?
Yes.
I wanted to respond to Thoreau. Basically, I think, he's right. Just wanted to add a couple of things. One is that when labor is indirectly social, you can actually work and your labor is not being averaged into anything because there's not demand for the product. So you could work real hard, but your labor does not count as social labor. It remains private labor that doesn't count as social labor because there's not a demand for the product. And that was one of the issues that really seemed to concern Proudhon and the Proudhonists. They were faced with glut. They were faced with recession, and all of a sudden the products don't sell. And they're saying, why does this thing have to exchange with money? And it really was not a question of money. It was really a question of demand. There wasn't demand for the product. The other thing I want to say is indirectly social labor takes one form when you have market-dominated capitalism. That is to say, the market acts as the mediator, as to how much and whether the labor that's indirectly social, how much social labor it counts as. In the USSR, in 1943, there was a very important article in the major theoretical journal, and it was supposedly about the teaching of Marxism, but they said that the law of value operates in socialism, and they were saying their society was socialist, and it's a commodity-producing society. So they said, basically Russia, they said, was socialist. Russia, they said, operated according to the law of value. Russia produced commodities. Russia had money, but they said that labor in Russia was directly social. And their argument as to why labor was directly social is that all labor that was validated as such, I don't know that they used that term, I don't think so, but all labor that was ratified as social labor according to the plan counted as labor. But that raises a very important question, I think, which is, has the plan replaced the market as the external mediator between the individual and society? Okay, so an individual works, what makes that count as part of social labor. Well, I think in this case it was their plan. So I wouldn't want to tie the concept of indirectly social labor to a particular manifestation of it. I think it can manifest itself in different ways. Over.
This is Stephanie. Can I say
something? Can I please say to...
Sorry.
Why don't we do Stephanie first and then Tolarev?
Okay, it's just really quick. So to my mind then, based on what Andrew said and something I had written down, when workers produce for value under capitalism, whether it's state capitalism or free market capitalism, that's what is indirectly social labor. Well, I hope that, I don't know if that makes sense. Over.
And Torov?
Yeah, I just wanted to say thanks to Andrew, but I also think there is a complete, is a different debate here, even a different class, maybe a different class, because from what I understand is that the law of value was still operating in the background, but the planners didn't have a clue about how much labor is needed to produce a thing, which was one of the peculiarities I've read recently about a reflective piece on the planning system. Over.
I think you're right that we're probably going to need to not get into that discussion now because that's taking us a different direction. But I do just I want to say a quick thing and then maybe I think we should move on to question two. Maybe two quick things. One, I think Andrew's last point about indirectly social labor is useful because he's highlighting what I think is a crucial distinction that sometimes people, I think, characterize indirectly social labor maybe in two different ways. One, it's characterized as purely the result of a lack of planning, really, that it's tied to anarchy of the market, to the competing individual producers without some sort of social planning agency, and that's what makes it indirectly social. And here, what has seemed to be the consensus so far in the discussion has been that Marx is actually using the indirectly adjective to refer to this process of social averaging where people's individual labors is only counted as social to the extent that it measures up to this social average. And that's with that definition, then the issue of whether or not society is planned doesn't necessarily have a bearing on this second sense, or maybe this primary sense, really, of indirectly social. And the other really short point I wanted to throw on there is that, you know, Marx is often, not just in his critique of Gray, but also in his critique of Proudhon and Derrimon and the rest of the Proudhonists is claiming that they are thinking that commodity producing labor can become directly social, and this is sort of a maybe unconscious assumption of theirs. And I think crucial to that is their theory that what is unequal about exchange is the money form, and that there's something privileged about money, and money is distorting the equality of the potential equality between producers. And if we get rid of money, we can solve this problem of equality between producers. Marx, of course, thinks that the money form comes from the commodity form. So you can't keep commodity production and get rid of money. That's an impossibility because he theorizes money as developing logically from the commodity form. But anyway, I think that's taking us on to question number two, and I think we should move forward since time is ticking. Question two is, why is money a necessary part of the organization of the capitalist mode of production? How is money different than other commodities? What would happen if a society was to attempt to carry out Gray's scheme And how does the critique of Gray relate to Marx's comments about vulgar socialism toward the end of the third section of the Gotha critique? We could take each one of those one at a time. Maybe for the interest of time, we can just take all those questions at a shot and see what we come up with. Who would like to jump in first? And please, people that haven't spoken yet, we should probably give them a priority. But of course, if they're not looking to speak, anyone should jump in.
Peter Jones?
Peter, please.
Thanks. Will, could you turn the recording on, please?
Kind of 19th century capitalist who tried these experimental, you know, building like Lord Lever in Liverpool and Merseyside. He built these, you know, extensive homes for the workers, and he planned recreation. But he never really tried, and I don't think any progressive, in inverted commas, capitalist tried any of this particular scheme that Gray suggested, which was kind of really, really far out. And maybe that explains why Andrew can't find a copy of the book, because it just immediately disappeared from history. Because it, you know, can someone correct me? Was it tried anywhere? Did anyone even try have you know, the inkling of beginning a scheme like this, and even on a desert, even an island somewhere? So yeah. So the fact that it disappeared in history presumes that, you know, really, you know, it was the most utopian of you know, the schemes dreamt up by maybe the utopian socialists or progressive capitalists in that era. Over.
Hi, this is Stephanie. I have something to say, but I want to hold it if there's somebody who hasn't spoken or somebody that wants to go before me. Over.
Okay.
This is Brian. I'll say something.
Brian, please.
About the last part of that question, how does the critique of Gray relate to Marx's comments about vulgar socialism towards the end of the third section of the critique of the Gotha program? I would say that in the critique of the Gotha program, we encountered the issues of the relations of distribution to production, and we delved into a lot of deep things about that. And I think the thing that we faced is state capitalist societies claiming to be socialist. And as we saw that comment, it's that socialism is made principally to turn on distribution. But as Brendan said when he introduced this question, money logically flows from the commodity. I think the law of value logically flows from the commodity. So even in a period of transition to a new society, if we have value production, then society's control is going to be abstract, because we can only plan after the fact. We can only plan in response to conditions instead of planning for the integral development of the individual. And I think that also his comments also strike a blow against the idea of an evolution to socialism by saying that these types of schemes would ultimately result in a return to capitalism or its own collapse. Over.
This is Ravi. I'd like to say something briefly.
Yes.
I mean, I remember during the the kind of 70s and early 80s, that there was various attempts to introduce direct barter schemes in which people would exchange their services and stuff they made directly without the use of money. But obviously you've then got the problem as to the rate at which they exchange, and quite often you find that these things last, well, they're launched and they last for a little while and then they just disappear, because obviously when you're trying to work out how much is worth something else, then the whole question of money and what the equivalency rate should be arises, which is why, as if you've got private exchange, then the law of value will assert itself at some point. You can't get rid of money in a commodity-producing society. Over.
Brendan?
Yes, is that Andrew?
Yes, it is.
Please.
Yeah, I wanted to tie this question in to the question about direct and indirect social labor. How is money different from other commodities? Well, just like not all labor is immediately social, not all commodities are immediately social. They're only commodities if they are saleable. Doesn't mean they have to be sold, but they have to be saleable. So, you know, they're just products produced by an individual or whatever, but they don't count as commodities if they're not saleable. Money is different. It is immediately a representation of value. When we say, how much is it worth, and we denominate that in money. And along with that, just as the labor that produces most commodities is not immediately social or directly social, but the money is different. The labor that produces the money, back in Marx's day you had produced money, gold, the labor that produces gold, gold mining labor, is immediately social labor because it produces something that immediately counts as value, unlike all other labor. And it seems to me that the this was going to what Peter Jones says. Once you have this system in which people's work doesn't count for what it is immediately, you have indirectly social labor, you need something that translates what an individual has done into what counts as labor at the level of society. And putting it another way, you need something to create a semblance of equality from a situation that is unequal. And money fulfills that function in the sense that well, it's really value that does it, but money is the way it shows up. You know, you do a certain amount of labor, but it produces more or less value, and it commands more or less money, the product does, than somebody else's equal amount of work. So, I think the prime thing is to try to create an equality or generality, as Peter was saying, from specific circumstances that are not said to produce the same result. Over.
Torev?
Yes?
One second, Andrew, could you just repeat the last sentence you said? I didn't catch it.
It was something, I don't remember the exact words, but something like you're trying to create a semblance of equality from a situation in which you've got a lot of individual acts of labor, a lot of individual commodities, and they're not, the different individual acts of labor are not said to yield the same result. So you have to create a semblance of equality because, well, the exchange system requires equality, but you're creating a semblance of equality from the lack of equality. And that's what money does, I think. Over.
Torov?
Yeah, I would just like to make a comment. We should get disheartened with this or feel frustrated, because the issues are everything but trivial, And it took Marx a lifetime to gain the insights that he had. Over.
Stephanie?
Yes, Stephanie.
Okay, so I answered clearly the first two parts of the question, and I think it's clear anyway. So I said that the money is a necessary part of the organization of the capitalist mode of production because it keeps indirectly social labor indirect, and it is essential to keep the market system flowing or operating at whatever rate in the cycle of capitalism it is flowing or operating at that time. So it becomes this kind of like holy mystical fetish thing. And then money is used to keep the means of production under the control of the capitalists and to keep the workers subject to the market in which they are the producers of all the capitalists' wealth. And then workers in that context of capitalism, they own, essentially, only their own labor power, which under capitalism becomes commodified and that is indirectly social labor because it is a thing with a price that is bought and sold. Okay, then I said, money is fetishized, turned into a magical and somehow untouchable substance, even though it is tangible, but there's never enough of it under capitalism, either for the capitalists themselves or for the proletariat. So you've got wealth and greed for wealth, or whatever the heck you want to call it, and then poverty or, you know, people that don't have as much of that money stuff. And money is different from other commodities because it possesses no intrinsic value, as it's an arbitrarily but very purposefully created commodity itself used that is only of use under very specific market circumstances. It satisfies no human needs and no human wants. Over.
I suspect that it might be a good time to move on to the third question, unless people have other things to say. I think that we've gotten at least the core idea about what's different about Marx's concept of money. Previous theorists, and even today, people often talk about money as being something that exists as a convenience, as a sort of something to escape just the difficulties of barter. So it purely is something there to make exchange easier. But Marx is relating value to the commodity form itself and saying that a society which is producing society of private laborers, which must go through this process of social averaging, necessarily generates this value form which stands apart from the laborers, and they must measure the value of their labor against this external measure. Relating back to, I think it was one of the first comments, I think maybe it was one of the Peters who was talking about what might go wrong if we put Gray's scheme into play. I think there were a lot of good things said about different things that might go wrong. Another thing that might go wrong would be that these time chips, this labor money itself, might actually become money again. It probably would just become the same as previous monies. Not because of the misconceptions of people or some sort of ill political will, but because of the nature of private production requiring this sort of value form. It looks like there's a note from Shane, maybe saying that he's found Gray's book on archive.org. So that'll be for the next reading group, right? Let's move on to question three. Marx's critique of Gray is relevant to understanding his critique of Proudhon. Is it relevant to any contemporary issues or thinkers? I guess we should probably try to keep our... I don't know how many different things people might come up with, but maybe we should try to keep our examples somewhat brief if we think of them. Go ahead, anyone who has an idea.
Well, it's Ravi. I know for a fact that the Socialist Party of Great Britain, which emerged after the Second International, part of their programme is the abolition of money as a way to create a post-capitalist society. Over.
This is Brian, I'll say something. I don't want to get into too much detail, but I think that when Marx critiques people who want a better society or a new society, he doesn't really delve into, you know, if they have advanced consciousness and things like that. He engages them on a level of logic. He engages their methodology and their prejudices. And that's what he went and said his entire life, including the circular letter written in 1878 or 1879, when he says that the Workers' Party, when it gains support among the bourgeoisie or the intellectuals, needs to fight against prejudices. And I think his critique of Proudhon, Gray, and other people within that sphere allows us to really see some of the deep fundamental flaws in the thinking of reformists and utopians and anarchists. And it's a really important thing to understand if you want to claim to actually fight for a new society. Over.
Can I comment on this one?
Yes, please.
You know, I don't know whether, apart from, I think we've mentioned the SPGB, I can't think of any theorists, especially on the left, who really even who've tinkered with this idea or played with this idea. I don't think it's an issue at all on the left. I think it's kind of, everyone kind of, you know, thinks, well, you know, money will always be with us. I think they just think the money's in the wrong hands and give more. That's just the problem of redistribution of money. So I don't know whether, I'd like to know if anyone can think of any theorists who talk about this. Because the minute that you raise it, you know, you kind of, people say like you're kind of a lunatic if you raise this idea, you know, bloody hell, you know, a society without money. I mean, even to raise it, I'm not talking about in a utopian sense, but in any sense, people, I think it's a big thing for ordinary people to get over that barrier of, you know, money is with us. So that's why maybe theorists aren't even brave enough to take this concept, because people think that you're crazy.
I could just throw in a couple examples that I was thinking of. I don't know if they're the most important examples, but I was thinking of, that sort of the more general gist of Marx's critique is this idea that, like I was saying earlier, that the money form is a result of the commodity form, and that attempts to sort of create a more equitable society by messing with money, by doing something with money, rather than doing something with production, are sort of just not going to take us anywhere. The two examples I immediately thought of were David Harvey and many of his speaking engagements, maybe even in the past couple of years, maybe even in his recent book, I'm not sure, I haven't read it, has been talking about his concept of oxidizable money. He thinks that if there was some way to create money that disappeared after a certain period of time, so that people were required to spend it rather than accumulate it, that this would do something for income equality and do something with inherited wealth, maybe. It's very unclear to me. It sounds like a really harebrained, crazy idea, but I've heard him talk about it more than once. So and then the second example I thought of was this modern monetary theory, which is has all sorts of adherence from some people, from various leftists, but not necessarily leftists, who have this idea that paper money, state-issued paper money, is different than commodity money, and that states could, through physical policy, have more freedom to spend, and that this somehow more progressive and equitable society could be created through this sort of new window that's opened up by non-commodity state-issued paper money. Those are the two examples that occurred to me. I wonder if other people have other thoughts about those examples or other examples that they could think of sort of social justice but through money manipulation.
Brendan?
Yes, is that Andrew?
Yes. Well, first of all, these time shift plans, they keep coming back, except found that there was something operating in Vermont where they have Vermont bread. You know, it's not real bread, but that's their time chit is called bread. And somebody sent me some Brixton bucks, Brixton being a neighborhood of London, not long ago. But the other thing I wanted to say is, this is like probably the primary social issue of our time, is this glaring inequality between rich industrialized and post-industrialized countries and what we used to call the third world. And people are very inclined, those who have some knowledge of Marxism, some knowledge is a dangerous thing, they're inclined to say that that's a matter of unequal exchange. And a theorist, published by Monthly Review, Rudy Emanuel, wrote a whole book basically saying that the system of international trade is a system of unequal exchange, because people in the third world, they produce stuff and doesn't command much money, per unit of time that they work, and people in the first world don't work so much, and they command a lot of value that way. So he was trying to make a sort of a second kind of exploitation going on, not only exploitation in production, but also exploitation. He didn't call it exploitation. He refrained from that, but something akin to exploitation operating in the international market. But the fact is that labor in capitalism is not directly social, and the fact that somebody works an hour does not mean that they have performed an hour of social labor, and how much social labor one's hour of labor counts as, it's not a matter of exchange, it's a matter of productivity. If you're doubly productive, your hour counts as double the amount of labor, and the productivity differences are just humongous. If you take a country like India and you take a country like the United States and you look at the productivity of agriculture, okay, there are some problems because this is mediated by value of money and so forth, but it's very, very clear that we're talking about just immense differences in productivity operating between these two countries. And because those differences in productivity matter, because they count, and that's because your labor is not directly social, that is the source of the poverty and tremendous inequality operating on a world scale. I mean, the productivity difference in agriculture between the U.S. And India, it's over 100 to 1.
Brendan, it's Paul.
Yes, Paul, please.
I just wanted to throw this out. It's probably not particularly significant, but the example that occurs to me, if I'm not mistaken, at some point, Muammar Gaddafi tried to abolish money. I don't remember the details of the experiment, but obviously it didn't get very far. Over.
This is Stephanie.
Yes, Stephanie.
So I said that it is relevant to contemporary issues. I couldn't think of any thinkers, like theoretical ones, but I remember years ago listening to some horrific thing on Democracy Now! Where Ralph Nader was talking about the super wealthy saving everybody's ass on the planet with all their money. So I just said that Marx's critique is relevant to today's problems because it addresses the social and economic problems created by capitalism and addresses the ineffectiveness of any band-aid solutions, no matter what era they're occurring in, like now with the democratic welfare state, state capitalism, national health care schemes, homelessness reduction programs, poverty reduction programs, market fixes via business sector incentives and tax shelters, microloans, housing and other loan refi schemes, credit in general, wars, whether they're military ones or those on drugs and poverty. And then it said that the good and noble moral God-given standard is that of the bourgeoisie. Under capitalism, it's still based on value, and it focuses on trying to achieve some kind of equity and distribution, but it doesn't address issues in production, realities in production. And then that maybe an effective way of organizing or viewing what happens in the next phases after the proletariat seizes control of the means of production is for workers to exploit the revolutionary capacity of societal changes so that what occurs during transitions is like, it has to keep in mind, I'm not being very, okay, it keeps in mind that we can't let those new forms of organization and production sink back into capitalistic hierarchical ones. Over.
Are there any other comments?
Anne? Okay, briefly. There may not be many groups other than the Socialist Party of Great Britain advocating the abolition of money, but there are a lot of, I think, reformist programs that that are similar in the sense of that they're totally dependent on redistribution and ignore problems in production. So as even if we can laugh off the Brixton dollars or the Vermont dollars, I mean, those are probably have to do with people working in the informal economy, as it were. They don't want to put any money in the bank. They're basically cheating on their taxes and take a barter instead of showing any income. That may not be important, but when you think about it, like any cooperative movement that thinks it's going to change society just by producing cooperatively and sharing equally in the proceeds without realizing the fact that they're still subject to the world capitalist system, the market for buying and selling in order to manufacture, you know, they're missing the boat. And then the millions of leftists we see every day, from, you know, Rick Wolf, Naomi Klein, Leo Panichin, those political people like him who think neoliberalism is at fault. It's always something other than production that's the problem. I mean, you know, Marx was clever to analyze capitalism, but that's not the real key. It's always something else in the world that can be controlled politically. And I know we're far afield, and I know we're doing this class because we want to get down to the nitty-gritty of what exactly is capitalism and what is socialism and what is not. But I just think, you know, Gray is very relevant because it's always something like that, some technique that people think can be used to finesse capitalism. And on that note, Brennan, if we have time at the end, I think we should discuss state capitalism a little, because it's the elephant in every meeting of the left, because it hasn't been reckoned with. And surely that's something that people need to come to terms with to understand what's capitalism and what is not. Over.
All right, Matthew, I've got a quick point of information.
Yes, please.
I live 15 minutes walk away from Brixton, and the Brixton Pound is not supposed to be an alternative to money. It's just a scheme to basically support your local economy. So it's a form of money in which you can spend it in local shops within Brixton, but you can't spend it wider afield. So it's supposed to keep money in the local area, and in no way is it a radical scheme. It is just about a form of local protectionism. Over.
Yeah, but I think maybe the larger point is that those like local money currency schemes are designed to sort of be some sort of antidote to, I don't know, global capitalism, and to create some sort of this localism fetishism as a response to globalization sort of politics. But yeah, they're definitely not marketed as anti-capitalist schemes. Are there other comments on this? Should we move on? I think maybe we should jump into question four, since that's the big question.
Could I ask Brandon to post the links to the Harvey and the other example he mentioned?
Yeah, I can try to find links to both of those things at some point. I can do that.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right, so we're jumping in.
Just to answer that, on MHI's website, there's a video of a meeting that Platypus put together 2 years ago now, at which Andrew spoke and Harvey spoke, and in the discussion, Harvey puts forth this oxidization of money solution, so no one can accumulate enough to control the means of production. Money's just going to disappear. He says it on that tape, on that video.
Question four. Is Marx's discussion of the lower stage of communism different from Gray's plan for a labor money system?
Brendan.
Yes.
My answer is yes.
Okay, moving on to question five then. I wonder if people can then say why it's, give us some good reason why it's different.
Tourette?
Yes, please.
Well, I also think that Marx's discussion is different because with Marx and the lower phase, there is no bank that administrates what Marx calls a pious wish. And instead, in the lower phase of communism, the material prerequisites are in place so that individual labor immediately counts as social labor. And if we want to understand what the material prerequisites are and what forms they have to take, I don't want to open a debate. I just want to point towards it. is that we have to look into property rights, because what Andrew and I discussed some time ago is just because we had we have legal ownership titles doesn't by itself, those ownership titles don't change a thing. Over.
Others.
Stephanie, it's basically just to encapsulate that with the lower stage of communism, you have socially direct labor, and with Gray's plan, you still have socially indirect labor. So...
Stephanie, can you just say the last part again? You were obscured by some music.
Sorry, we've got practice and theory happening at the same time in the household. Okay, the practicing is over. I said that with the lower stage of communism, you have socially direct labor, and with Gray's plan for a labor money system, you still have socially indirect labor. Over.
Anne?
Yes, Anne.
Just no one else wants to. Yeah, but to get down to the nitty gritty, Marx doesn't spell it all out in the Critique of the Goat program. Remember, he tells us that he's already worked it out in Capital, and we should have learned it by now. So I think it's okay to read in a little bit into that lower phase of what we learned from Capital. Certainly, in the lower phase of communism, when labor has become directly social, the workers are organizing and planning production. So they're no longer producing for value, social relations or human relations, instead of commodity relations. There's no more value. There's no money representing value. So the fact that both Gray's scheme and his lower phase issue certificates for hours of work, it doesn't go to the essence of what it is, because in Gray's plan, the only thing that's affected is distribution, what you do with your certificate for hours of work and how they're on what basis they're issued, and who's controlling the whole process. Someone just mentioned this super bank that actually not only issues your certificates, but holds all the goods in the world and doles them out, and because of that role, necessarily is actually planning production. So it's like we've got one big Soviet Union and a bank or something. In Marx's idea, everything has changed about production. And that's why there can be a fair method of distribution. But, of course, there's not yet so much plenty that everyone can have whatever he wants without any regard for the need to work. That would be, we hope, the higher phase of communism. But it's we don't have the material basis for it yet. And he says here, just let me, where is it? Page 10, 11. Oh, well, you all know this, the last paragraph of section 3 of the critique, he sort of sums it all up. Over.
Brendan, it's Paul.
Yes, go ahead.
For me, question 4 really is the central question, as others have suggested. My difficulty with this question is, I've expressed this in writing an email, that when we talk about the lower stage of communism, the way we tend to describe it is by using language that in effect is the negation of those elements that are central to capitalism. So when we talk about the lower phase of communism, we say, well, of course, you know, this is not like Gray's scheme, because we've abolished value production, we've abolished commodity production, labor is directly social, workers are in control of the economy. And all of that sounds very nice to me, but it still sounds very abstract. I can't, at least not yet, get a clear picture of how that is supposed to work in a concrete way. And then I get even more concerned, is the right word, I think, when we contrast the lower form of communism with the higher form of communism, because the higher form of communism, it seems to me, constitutes, even though it still remains abstract, the embodiment of a principle that I understand. And I understand how it would work. The idea that the productive forces have advanced to the point where labor is essentially decoupled from the meeting of basic human needs so that people can essentially get what they want and then contribute to a process, I'm not even sure I would call it production anymore, almost a kind of praxis in which people are going about being their creative selves, producing, of course, but the word has very different connotations. That all seems to me to be based on using the development of the productive forces to transcend what we might think of in current terms as the misery of contemporary economic life. But when you talk about in the lower phase of communism and you start saying things like, well, of course, you know, we've abolished all this stuff we associate with capitalism, but of course the productive forces aren't yet fully developed, so people can't expect to get what they want. We're still going to have to base distribution on labor inputs. That's when I start to get nervous, because unless I can, at least for myself, concretize precisely how that's going to work in such a way that, frankly, all, forgive the language, but all the old shit doesn't wind up coming back again. Or alternatively, that you wind up never being able to organize production in accordance with these ideals, because what you get is anarchy, a kind of interminable conflict that ultimately undermines the revolutionary process itself. So I don't know whether we want to try to get into details, if anybody has any ideas, or whether it's too big a question and we don't want to try to tackle it. But it seems to me that if question four is going to have real meaning, we need to put some meat on the bones. Over.
Brendan, it's Ravi. I'd like to speak.
Yes, Ravi.
I think one of the things that sort of comes out of the discussion about the lower phase of communism, and it also relates to the discussion we were having, and wants to talk about state capitalism later. This is also anticipating question five to some extent, because the exchange of labour as opposed to the exchange of products, I think, is what distinguishes the lower phase of communism from Gray's system or from capitalism more broadly, which is that if you're describing it as an exchange of labour, it's not really exchange in the individualised way that you would think of it under capitalism, which is why I think exchange is possibly it's a confusing way of describing it. Because I think conscious planning, using the democratic control of the whole society, of the labourers themselves, or the cooperation of freely associated labour is a better way of putting it, in which the production is done for social need. You make things according to what people want, rather than making things and then working out how you're going to get rid of them, which is what happens in the capitalism, that things are produced with the expectation of being able to sell them for a return. Rather than that, production is planned in advance, and people's labour is organised accordingly, according to a consciously organised social plan of production that the workers design for themselves. And I think that's the way in which you would kind of differentiate the lower face of communism from anything that we've got at the moment. Over.
Brenton?
Yes.
I think Paul asked the question, not only of this class series, but the question of our day. And I don't think anyone has the answer, and I don't think Marx had the answer at this, when he wrote, which is why we don't find the answer in Marx. And this is among the reasons why we say that this is the foundation for organization rather than here are all the answers. It does help when you've lost your keys not to look under the lamppost, just because that's where all the light is. So what we're doing is we're looking in the dark corner, and we're going to have a better chance of finding our keys than by doing this than by doing what's typical, which is look under the lamppost and talk about distribution and talk about ownership and so forth. But what we have is, money, distribution, that depends on commodities and commodity production. And that depends on the existence of value. And the existence of value depends on indirectly social labor. But what does indirectly social labor depend on? What makes labor indirectly social, and what will make it directly social? Just like Thoreau said, you change titles to property, it doesn't do anything. You have your Confederation of Workers' Councils declare that, all labor is directly social, an hour of labor is going to count as an hour. Well, that's just an empty declaration. It's a pious wish. We have a question to which we do not have the answer yet. But I do think we're looking in the right place rather than under the lamppost. And that is really why I think that we want so much. This is among the major questions that we have to answer, and this is why I think we want so much attention drawn to this, because if we don't answer this, we're back to the same empty voluntarism, political determinism, the ideas that the power comes from the barrel of a gun, and we're just going to change society, through military might or whatever. If somebody can come up with the answer right now, that'd be great, but I think it's a really long, long project. It's going to involve a lot of people, and it'll involve, this class, but I think we need to continue with this, and then this is, one of the things that MHI has dedicated itself to doing. So I think it's premature to ask for a solution, even though the question is absolutely the right question. Just because we haven't found a solution yet doesn't mean that there isn't one. There hasn't been a lot of work done on this issue. People have been looking under the lamppost. Over.
Brendan, it's Paul again. I've already spoken, so I'll hold off if somebody else wants to get in on this, but I do want to follow up.
Okay. Well, does someone want to speak prior to Paul?
I do just want to say something quickly, Peter Jones.
Yes.
So when I have discussions with who I call, for lack of a better word, bougie people about Marxism and the very rudimentary ways that I have them, because I'm not steeped in this tradition, there's always this, you know, but you can't have this because Paul talked a lot about that already very explicitly. There's always this thing of, you know, it's sort of about the debate of human, you know, what is human nature? And I guess what I'm getting more profoundly from association with Marxist humanists, and particularly this class, is the idea of, that we have to get away from the way that we frame things economically and socially. And it's very hard for people to imagine. I mean, I don't even know if we're going to have what we call civilization, you know, in the future. And I don't mean this in a, you know, a scary way. It's just what we know about civilization has much to do with power over and hierarchies and enslavement of vast amounts of the population. And to have people, you know, producing each according to their abilities and receiving each according to their needs, when we are at that point, when we're really at that point, I'm not saying how we're going to get there, but it will be very different. It's just people are scared. I think they're more scared of transition than anything else, rather than a transformation. And I don't think that there's, I mean, like the kind of anarchy in production, I don't think that anarchy in production is going to happen. Maybe I've gotten too optimistic because of Marxism, but if the proletariat take over the means of production and the terms of production change that radically, I don't think that anarchy in the productive arena is going to be the issue. Over.
I know that Paul is on stack. Maybe I wanted to maybe try to respond quickly to a couple of things you said, Paul. I think that that what I like about one thing you mentioned was that the things are being dealt with very abstractly when we're in the Gothic critique about the lower stage, and that's one of the things that I think is really helpful and powerful about the approach Marx is taking there, because usually when we're talking about communism, we get into these much more concrete discussions about how planning works and the specific organization of production, and so really they're sort of like distribution kind of questions or production questions that aren't dealing with the more abstract nature of society. And what's great about Marx is one of the things, I guess, that's great about Marx's critique of capital is that he is understanding capitalist society from its most abstract determinants, and then showing how those abstract determinants, the commodity form, expands to create this larger set of relations that is a capitalist society and all this concrete determinativeness. So when in the Gothic critique he is trying to identify a way of breaking with value production, I think that is the answer, or at least as part of the most abstract beginning of an answer of how we, as you say, don't just end up with all the same shit again. In order to not end up with all capital social relations again, we have to have a way that the remuneration of people's labor doesn't just turn into money, and the work of individuals doesn't have to measure against this abstract social average in order to become social labor, and so the value doesn't arise out of the production relations. And he's giving us a very brief picture of what that might look like in a very abstract way. And it springs almost like it springs very naturally out of his critique of capital. It's not like it's just some nifty idea Marx has, though wouldn't it be cool if we organized society this way. It comes directly out of his critique of capitalism. So it's rooted in this very thorough understanding of capitalism. I'll say over. Peter, do you want to speak again then?
Did you mean Paul?
Oh, sorry, Paul. A lot of people with P names in this group.
That's okay. Let me just say, first of all, I agree with Andrew that we don't have a solution and that this is a really important question. And I'm not so sure that we're supposed to have a solution, precisely because it seems to me that the solution, we're going to just have to settle for this, and maybe rightfully so, is going to come about as the direct result of both developments in the forces of production and the relations of production due to the continuing class struggle. That doesn't mean that we can't look for ways to try to make the solution to this more concrete. What we're doing in this seminar is one way. Myself, in order to try to envision what this is going to look like, I'm intrigued by the possibility that we get clues from examining changes in the forces of production that have taken place largely as the result of the revolution in telecommunications, computing power, which seems to me to provide a material basis in some sense for being able to correlate the enormous amount of information that will have to be correlated if we're to come up with some kind of plan for producing for need under the control of an organized working class. I also think that Stephanie's comments about what happens when she talks to her bourgeois friends is important, because I also think that we need to recognize that our own thinking is so polluted by the limitations placed on our imaginations because we live under capitalism. And it is very, very hard to realize that when you think about these problems, you may be thinking of them from within a box that has boxed you in because you're so used to thinking of them in terms of the way things are now as opposed to the way we think they ought to be. And so I think it's very important to sort of try to think outside the bourgeois box. That's difficult. And Brendan, I mean, I'm certainly aware of the dialectic between the abstract and the concrete that constitutes Marx's method. I'm not, of course, suggesting that what I'm referring to as his abstractions are without value. Quite the contrary, without that sense of determination to be able to imagine an alternative to capitalism that he represents, we would be in a lot worse shape. And so I'm certainly not suggesting that those abstractions are without value. The problem is how we translate those into some kind of workable vision so that we can at least be clear in terms that folks can understand what it is we're suggesting the future will be like. I do think this is extraordinary. I mean, if we think about how enormously complicated a modern economy is, how many different things are produced. And now I'm not only talking about, you know, just because it's, we got this sort of craziness in capitalism where you produce things not for need but for profit, regardless of whether they actually fulfill needs or you create artificial needs and all that. But I mean, even if we were really trying to meet genuine human needs and trying to think those through, the fact is it's an enormously complicated issue. And there will probably be as many opinions about this as there are human beings. Not that we won't have things in common, because we are, after all human beings. But we're going to have a whole lot of things that need to be ironed out. And it seems to me that one difference between our time and the time that Marx was writing in the 19th century is that if you think of this on a worldwide basis today, it seems to me that I couldn't even imagine how this would work if we were still using the methods of communication available in the 19th century or even in the early 20th century. We perhaps have a, as I say, some kind of material basis for believing that this kind of communication and coordination would be possible, but it's still going to be extraordinarily difficult, so difficult that, as I say, I'm still having trouble wrapping my mind around it. But I'm glad that everybody at least thinks that this is a really key question, and that even if we can't answer it now, we need to keep it in mind and explore various ways of getting closer to an answer, of which this seminar is one way, and I think there are others as well. Over.
Brendan, it's Ravi. I'd like to say something very quickly.
Yeah, let's try to keep it quick. Shane has reminded me that we have two more big questions to get to before we run out of time here.
Okay, just very quickly on Paul's point. I think one of the things that we need to be a little bit kind of conscious of is that when we're discussing change in the way in which we might envisage it happening, is that it's always going to be difficult for us under capitalism, particularly when we're not in a particularly revolutionary period, to imagine what the kind of acceleration of that sense of possibility means for society more broadly, because the expectations that are built, even in a conservative country like Britain, from the changes that took place in the early 20th century with the impact of the Russian Revolution, you can see that if there's change anywhere in the world, that the impact of that globally will be so much more intense than even in the past. And I think that kind of sort of beacon that is provided for everybody is something it's very difficult to account for in the kind of period which seems very quiet that we're living in now. Very briefly on Peter's thing, when he was talking about if people want to go off and do their own thing and they don't want to be involved in the kind of overall planning of production, I think that's, we shouldn't lose sight of what last week's discussion was around the dictation of the proletariat, because essentially what those people would be doing if they're talking about exchanging their products and selling them is reintroducing the law of value and reinstituting capitalism. And that's something that a worker state wouldn't put up with. So kind of bourgeois notions of tolerance and democracy will only go so far when there's something that is actually going to undermine the ability to create a cooperative society. And I think that kind of development would be suppressed by the working state. I think that's just how how you'd have to do it. Over.
Let's jump on to the last two questions and see if we can get through them. And I know also Anne wanted to talk about state capitalism. So that's three questions. Jeez. Okay.
Brendan, I just meant if there was time and as it arose naturally in these questions.
Okay.
I don't mean to create another question.
Okay.
You're in enough trouble now getting through these three.
Yes. All right, so question five. Marx accuses bourgeois thinkers of idealizing individual exchange, not recognizing the mode of distribution of products comes from the mode of production. Considering Marx's description of the lower phase of communism and the Gothic critique, what are the distinctive features of a communist mode of production, and what form of distribution of the products of labor flows from it? How does Marx's distinction between the exchange of labor and the exchange of products of labor relate to this question? We've already covered these points. We can move to question six. But if people think we have, that there are still things to cover on this question, we can, I guess, stay on it. Are there opinions about that?
This is Stephanie. I think because we want to save time, I think we've covered a lot of this stuff, and maybe some of it will even be talked about as we answer the last two questions. So I'm for going ahead, but I'm willing to go with whatever what the rest of the group wants to do. Over.
Do we have objections to moving on? I don't want to put it that way. Any objections to moving on to six?
Let me just say something really quickly.
Yes.
Just so like we're all on the same page. Marx spells out in the critique within the cooperative society based on common ownership of the means of production. So that's one feature, common ownership. The producers do not exchange their products. That's the second feature, and that answers the last part of this question. Just as little does the labor employed on the products appear here as the value of these products. So there's no value. Because labor is no longer exists in an indirect fashion, but directly, so we have directly instead of indirectly social labor. And then he gives us additional features of the lower phase and additional features of the higher phase, or really prerequisites of the higher phase. But I think it is important to deal with the full sense of what he's talking about, labor being directly social, but I think that's covered in 6C. So I just want to say that when we get to 6C, I think we're dealing with features of the lower phase. Over.
Well, let's plow into these this three-part question number six, then. We'll do one point at a time. 6A is, why does Marx say that the fluctuation of supply and demand is crucial for the determination of value by labor time? And then I give this quote from the Poverty Philosophy. If Mr. Proudhon admits that the value of products is determined by labor time, he should equally admit that it is the fluctuating movement alone that in society founded on individual exchanges make labor the measure of value.
Some price. trust that says to you, yes, it turns out that your labour was socially necessary or not. And so it needs to fluctuate, otherwise value on price would be the same thing. And so it's the way the system, it's the way a market economy determines whether or not your labour time is socially necessary, which wouldn't be needed under a, you know, commonly planned economy because you would have decided that in advance. Over.
That sounds good to me. Does anyone have anything that we has been left out of that answer?
Tolev, I would like to ask a question.
Please.
Maybe I have misread that quote. There's another quote that relates to part A, but this I'd like to read it because I get very confused. So Marx then goes on saying, what determines value is not the time taken to produce a thing, but the minimum time it could possibly produced in, and the minimum is ascertained by competition. I'm troubled by the word minimum. So far, I always thought it's the average. Over.
Brendan?
Yes.
To answer Turov's question, Marx changed his view between his Poverty of Philosophy and then when he wrote Capital. But the average, keep in mind, is an average of what is needed right now. So it does inform, it does have features of the minimum. In other words, it's not the average of all the products brought to market that determines the value, but the average amount of labor needed to produce the thing right now. So among the points that Marx is talking about against Proudhon, you know, you get a revolution in production and it takes only half the amount of labor before. Well, under Marx's conception as laid out in Capital, the same consideration is there that the labor, half of it does not count because it's not because it's not the minimum time, but because it's not, it's well above the social average determined by the amount of labor currently needed to produce the commodity. But also, just on the fluctuating movement of supply and demand, part of what I think is needed to understand this is that, given certain qualifications that Marx has not stated here, when supply and demand are equal, the products exchange at their value. Okay? So, it's the fluctuations of supply and demand that keep this standard operational. In other words, if supply becomes too big relative to demand, the price falls, bringing the price back toward value. And the opposite in the case of too much demand, the price rises, bringing it back towards the value. So it's, as he says, it's a constituting movement. It's the move, the fluctuations of supply and demand, which lead to alterations in prices, bringing prices in line, not in an equilibrium, but in a pattern fluctuating around the value. Over.
Let's jump on to B. How is the determination of value by labor time turned into a ball of disproportion?
I can come in on this, Ravi.
Yes, Ravi.
I think that the point on this is that the moving towards equilibrium doesn't mean it's ever going to be achieved, because it is one of those things that, because it's a society that has no conscious plan, the very kind of disproportion between supply and demand means that, as Andrew just said, that value and price are not the same as each other, and the fact that
price tends to gravitate towards value doesn't mean that it's ever going to coincide with it, but it's always an attempt to square those two values across society as a whole that is the movement that shapes price as a whole. And each individual capitalist's share of the total produced will be determined by their total capital in relation to the capital employed across society as a whole. I hope that's clear. Over.
What, since time is ticking, let's just jump on to C. In his discussion of the lower phase of communism and the critique, Marx says, but as far as the distribution of the latter among the individual producers is concerned, the same principle prevails as in the exchange of commodity equivalents. A given amount of labor in one form is exchanged for an equal amount of labor in another form. Hence, equal right here is still in principle. Bourgeois right, although principle and practice are no longer at loggerheads, while the exchange of equivalents in commodity exchange exists only on the average and not in the individual case. Close quote. How does the lower phase allow for the distribution of equivalents, quote, in the individual case? And how is this different than the determination of value through the movement of supply and demand? Can the products of the lower phase be said to have values? We've covered some of this, but not all of it. Thoughts?
I'd say the products of the lower phase can't be considered as values.
Yes, hopefully we're all have come to that conclusion now. But speak of if someone disagrees. How about the rest question?
Tolaev, I think I have an important quote here.
Please.
Yeah, Marx writes, no one, well, in the lower phase, no one can give anything except his labor. And because, on the other hand, nothing can pass to the ownership of individuals except individual means of consumption. Over.
Brendan's Paul.
Yes, Paul.
Now, again, I think this brings us back to the hard part of the question and the crux of the matter. I still don't understand how this gets measured. I understand the quote that Dorov just read. I think it's an important quote. It has to do with the fact that no one winds up with the ability to own anything other than, that is, privately, anything that is other than what one is entitled to consume on the basis of the labor time that one contributes. But I'm still hung up on how to measure the labor time. We had that sort of interaction and email over the question of the relationship between what some were calling the intensity of labor and what I was suggesting was actually a measure of the efficiency of labor. I don't understand how this is supposed to work. I was sitting around before the session began today trying to imagine what it would be like for somebody, say, who was a baker producing loaves of bread, and somebody who was working on something which everyone agreed was a genuine use value, but was a far more complicated project labor time to realize, even before you could get, say, just one unit of production finished, trying to figure out how you're going to say to folks, well, an hour of labor is an hour of labor as long as you are working efficiently as possible. It just strikes me that there's something missing in this picture. And what bothers me is it goes back to the comment that Shane made before about the necessity somehow of the using the proletarian state apparatus to keep folks in mind. I had thought that we had agreed, Pace Marx's response to Bakunin, that there is no repressive state apparatus during the lower phase of communism. And it seems to me that we're still confused about all of this precisely because we can't, I mean, at least I can't get a handle on what this is supposed to look like. Over.
Sorry, were you saying that you thought that Marx was saying that there was no coercive state in the lower phase of communism? Is that you right there?
Yes. What I thought was that that we had agreed that the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat was during the period of transition between capitalism and communism and was not itself and had nothing to do with the lower phase of communism, because at the lower phase of communism, class antagonisms have already been abolished. Over.
Brendan?
Yes.
I think Paul's recollection of the answers that were given to the questions last week is correct. I think this is just from memory. Question 2 and 4 related to that issue. So if you're not sure, Ravi, look at those questions again and any notes that you may have taken. But on this question 6C, I just want to say Marx does not mention efficiency. Okay? That would be really, I think, contrary to his whole conception. He's basically saying if you do an hour's work, it counts as an hour's work. And immediately, without any mediation, once you start to talk about efficiency considerations, the individual's labor is being mediated by some standard social efficiency. You might as well call that value. And I think that that's what he's saying we got to get beyond. I think it's pretty easy to measure the amount of time that people work. He says the amount of time for labor to be measured has to be measured by duration or its intensity. If you think that intensity is too hard to measure, so you've got the alternative, the duration of labor. It's not hard to measure. But I think that, you know, there are miraculous feats performed, as I said on the email, with measurement that we take for granted. We don't bat an eyelash. And, you know, when the rate of inflation rises, it falls, it gets measured as 2.1%, 1.7%. You know, it's like you don't want to look at how those numbers are produced. There's a lot of assumptions in there. It's a makeshift for practical purposes. And I think that intensity can be measured in a makeshift way for practical purposes in a classless society we're talking about here. We're not talking about a class-ridden society. And, you know, it's going to be such that just some people are going to be doing more work within a given period of time. It's obvious that this does take place, and question is then just, you know, maybe in a rough and ready way, how do you get a handle on that? Over.
Again, Brendan, it's Paul. I want to respond, but I'm going to hold off in case others want to get into this. Over.
Picking up on Andrew's point, we could look at this class two ways. One, we weren't efficient and didn't get to all seven questions, but we could also say we all put in 2 hours of work. And anyway, that was a bad joke. I don't think I can stick around to answer question seven. Maybe another, I could do another 5 minutes, but that probably won't be adequate. Perhaps we can move question seven to email, and we can finish up this question of 6C now with last points. Do people have, besides Paul, have other comments about 6C?
This is Stephanie. I have a quick one, and it's just that thing that Mark said of, to you know, from each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs, and that's that crux. So we have a real hard time getting our heads around, and I loved your joke. I put in a heck of a lot of hours on this class, and I wasn't very efficient. Thanks. Over.
Paul, why don't you respond then if there are other... I think that's Anne coughing in the background.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go for it.
I was worried about relegating seven to the email because last week we relegated things to the email and they were not actually discussed specifically in terms of the readings. So I would sort of rather maybe if, Brendan, you took a few minutes to give us your answers to six and seven, and then we can continue the discussion of everything on the email. Just a suggestion.
I could attempt to give my answers. Paul, can you give us your comment about 6C before we move on then to my attempted answers?
Just quickly, what I would say is if efficiency drops out, if we're not measuring people's contributions on the basis of unit of output, but just in terms of labor time, and Andrew and I have already had something of a disagreement about how you measure intensity, we can let that go because we're out of time, but if, in fact, we just use labor time, it's going to require a sea change in attitude, which, of course, given that we've abolished capitalism in the lower phase of communism, maybe we have reason to suspect will have had to occur prior to achieving this anyway, where people will not be pointing fingers at each other and saying, oh, well, but, you know, I mean, I do so much more than you do in just an hour, so why should I get the same amount of stuff in return, the same claim on the social product as you? And if we exceed, that is to say, if we give in to the idea that there will be different claims on the social product, that makes me nervous precisely because it reintroduces, if not class differences, then differences in stratification that can very easily lead to the resumption of all the old shit. Now, just quickly in response to Stephanie, remember that in the lower phase of communism, the principle is from each according to his ability, or to each according to his work, not to his need. And that's the problem we have. I can actually much more easily envision the higher phase, provided that we have sufficient development of productive forces. If people can have whatever they want, then economics is no longer an arena of conflict, and we've moved on to bigger and better things, and maybe finally accomplish the end of the prehistory of humanity, and we can finally get on to the history of humanity. But when you start talking about, you know, to each according to his work, again, I still get very nervous whether you measure it in intensity or in labor time. But maybe it's a matter of a new consciousness. Over.
I've got a very short point to make, if possible.
Okay.
I think the distinction between private property and personal property is worth making here, because obviously in the distribution of the product in a different kind of society, if you're consuming a certain amount of the product, then obviously by definition someone else can't have it, and in that sense it is your personal property. However, that it should be distinguished between the meaning of that and private property as it's understood under capitalism, where the kind of accumulation of a certain amount of stuff will give you power over someone else. In other words, the possession of certain things in relation to the means of production means that you will start to gain social power. That would not be kind of permitted, whereas the possession of personal property would be. And that's why I don't think the kind of allocation of social product would have the devastating consequences that you're talking about, Paul. Over.
Can I say something quickly? It's Peter. Geez. 20-odd years ago, teaching was a completely different profession. Now it's extremely intensive and people measure each other because competition is being brought in. I can easily envisage being measured in terms of labour time and not intensity. It would, because 20 years ago, people were doing, it was about quality. Now you've got people working 80-odd hours a week, plus 80-plus hours a week in teaching, and that is solely because they've brought in competition. And just the elements of competition between teachers, between schools and so on, has created people in a kind of, people are policing themselves in terms of the amount of hours they do. But that didn't used to happen. So I can say, I agree with the mindset thing, but it wouldn't be a big leap, I think, to do that. But it's difficult, you know, taking a step outside the box to imagine it. Especially young teachers, they think it's just normal. It's normal that you've got to work 70, 80 hours a week. Over.
I feel like the question of how people's opinions to the fairness of distribution is in lower phases, like it's just sort of a not that it's unimportant, but I feel like that's not the, well, I won't jump into the thing. I think it's too big to talk about right now. I can actually disagree. I don't think it's that radical a break for people to conceive of that kind of fairness. And I mostly because I feel like with modern production, it's very hard to draw a line between one person's output and another's anyway. And that the labor is a much more practical way of measuring one's contribution than output in a globally socialized production chains and the like. But let me just as Anne requested, a few brief answers to the seven questions. They'll probably be inadequate, and then people can, my inadequacies will be a springboard for vibrant email discussions. So 7A, Marx argues that a stable balance of supply and demand was a feature of older society, and that calls to reestablish this equilibrium are reactionary. What production relations are necessary for such a balance? And why does modern industry form the basis of a different relation between supply and demand? If I'm remembering back to the points of the poverty philosophy, Marx is arguing that this past society with a stable balance of supply and demand as a society of individual commodity producers and probably not a society in which the bulk of production is commodity production. And so there isn't sort of the constant revolutionizing of the means of production that you have in a capitalist society where efficiency and productivity are changing
and output is changing, and demand is constantly changing in relationship to new products and the changing value of labor power. So this whole dynamism of capitalist production isn't in the picture. And that then, I think, answers the second part of that question, that a modern industry produces this different basis for the relationship of supply and demand, because now we have a constantly fluctuating value relations, because production is constantly being revolutionized in this fight over socially necessary labor time. Question B, Marx's critique, the just proportions of exchange, why are they reactionary? They're reactionary because they are built on this sort of mythology of a previous society and not taking into consideration the nature of modern capitalist production. And then the last question, part of the question, how is Marx's analysis of the lower phase of communism not just the repetition of these reactionary calls for just proportions of exchange? I think maybe the most basic answer is that that Marx is not talking about proportions of exchange at all, at least not exchange of products. He's talking about a distribution of products based on people's contribution to society, but not on the exchange of products in a market. That would be the most basic answer. I'm sure there's more to it. And do you have any last notes about, are we meeting next week? Is it Sunday, the next class?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we have two more meetings next Sunday and the following Sunday.
Just wanted to make sure it wasn't delayed because of the holiday here in the U.S. next week. And so we are meeting Sunday, 4 to 6.
Yes.
Okay. Any other notes before we sign off then?
I just have a quick question. I know that this is being recorded. Is it something that we can, is there some site we can go to hear what we've been saying so far, or is that
not yet? They will be distributed later, but it's not available now. I don't want to keep Brendan any longer. I would just ask that people write about 7C, because that's the one I had trouble with. So maybe we can make sure that we've got this stuff from Poverty of Philosophy down. It's not easy. Anything else, Brendan?
No, I disagree. I would disagree that it's not easy. So I'll second.
Can I ask a question?
It seems to me that 7C is a repeat, really, of question 4.
Yes.
I think we pretty much well answered it. I would also like to butt in and say one more thing about the bankruptcy of Gray's National Bank.
Oh, great.
Okay. I don't think it was said. Maybe I'm wrong. But if you take, like, say, the economic crisis of the last decade, you'd have, like, instead of houses not being sold, you'd have people continuing to build houses that nobody had the means to buy anymore. So the bank would be the possessor of all these houses that he couldn't do anything with. And on the other hand, you know, all these construction workers, et cetera, would be drawing down the stores of, you know, food and clothing and cars and whatnot. And, you know, the bank would be bankrupt. Over.
Brendan, it's Paul. Just very, very quickly, I think Andrew is right. C is equivalent to 4. When he says we've answered it by saying we don't have an answer, which is why I suspect Ann is having so much difficulty with it, as I am. Over.
Well, thanks everyone for their thinking and their careful thinking, and we'll see each other next week.
hope everybody can make it. Nobody had asked to move it because of the holidays, so we didn't. So write if you're not going to be here. Please try to be here. And please do the readings. They're not easy. You'll get questions in the next day or so, and we'll try to help with the readings. So anybody has anything else to say besides good night or good morning, depending on where you are?